Welcome to SEC Sports Roundtable, episode 113, Snowed In, recorded Tuesday, January 28th, 2014. This week's episode goes right off the rails, and what else should we talk about if it's not sports? It's the weather. So the roundtable this week follows the lead of that big game in the NFL and talks snow. When they do get back on track, Nick Jones and Shane Bailey discuss the reversal of the top 25. Can Manziel be the number one overall pick? Signing day, and much more on this week's SEC SRT. Welcome to SEC Sports Roundtable. This is your host, Shane Bailey. Back after a short hiatus, we've come to realize that the basketball season, it's not going to be a weekly podcast. We're going to about every 10 days or so. If we can get it weekly, we're going to be happy to get one in. It's just difficult to do that right now. So for the next little bit, we've been doing about every 10 days, and if we can get it to a week, we will. But we are a podcast that talks SEC sports. We do football, basketball. Apparently, Blair Smiley, who's on here regularly, has informed me that baseball is right around the corner. So we do talk some baseball occasionally on here as well. But tonight I've got Nick Jones from Bama Hammer joining me. Nick, welcome.
I understand. Hey Shane, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I understand that you are snowed in down there in Tuscaloosa.
You know, I hope and I think primarily, I don't really hope, we need a national audience, right? But I think most of the people who listen to this podcast are probably centered in the Southeast. But for those who have happened upon this, whether that be on YouTube or somewhere else, and you're in Ohio or New York or something, snowed in is not the same term that you use. We got about an inch and a half of snow here in Tuscaloosa, where I am on the campus of the University of Alabama. Surprisingly, we actually had classes until 11. They decided to back off that. So we canceled classes after 11. No school tomorrow. But and Shane, I don't know if you follow too many people in the Birmingham area, but it is wild. They got 2 or 3 inches of snow in the Birmingham area, and it was kind of strange because normally how southeastern snow works, at least I know past Tennessee on into Alabama and things, is we normally get like freezing rain or rain or something, and it ends up coating the roads, and you know, it's just like a sloshy mess, but it always dries up. Well, we actually got powdery snow this time, what probably most of the country is familiar with, and it covered the roads. So and another thing is, this was all forecasted to be a lot farther south than us, so nobody was aware of it. Everybody's in downtown Birmingham. People are stuck. There's no vacancies downtown. People are abandoning their cars on the side of the road, walking home if they can. If not, they're spending the night in their cars. So I don't know. I mean, is this what the apocalypse looks like? I have no clue. But like my dad is downtown. He's going to be spending the night at work. My mom is at a coworker's house. So I don't know. It's weird, Shane. I'm just lucky to live on campus and be able to walk everywhere. So at least I'm not snowed in per se, but it's been an interesting day, to say the least.
Well, folks below the state line of Tennessee, which is where the podcast originates out of, we're here in Nashville. You guys just really don't have snow equipment. I mean, there's no major salt trucks. There's no, brine. We do brine up here. It's a saltwater mix, and there's no snow plows really down there. So when you get any accumulation, there's no way to get it off the roads. And 2 inches is not an apocalypse. I'm dating myself a little bit, but in the early 90s, I believe it was 92. I was actually trying to think about this today. We were headed to spring break. And so from Nashville down to Panama City Beach, where all the, you know, all the action is, you have to go through Birmingham.
Yeah.
Well, we get south of Nashville, south of Franklin, really, and it starts snowing. And it continues to snow and snow. And by the time we reached Birmingham, there was about 6 to 8 inches on the ground. Literally, like you said, there are cars. There's hundreds of cars stopped on the interstate. We slept in the floor of some hotel. I don't even know what hotel it was. There was hundreds of college-age kids just camped out on the floors because the hotels had nowhere else to put you. They just let you say, well, come on in. You can sleep on my floor. They didn't charge us anything. We just ransacked their hotel for the night. Got back up, and the roads had cleared off enough. I think you ended up getting like 14 to 18 inches in Birmingham.
Yep. That was the blizzard of 93.
93.
And just like you said, it was in April. It was earlier to mid-April, which was really strange. But envision that with less snow, but just as much panic, which makes it worse.
So. And what's great is we finally make it to Panama City Beach the next day, and it's already, you know, they got snow down that far south, too, to the beach. Uh-huh. It was already up in the mid-70s by the time we arrived the next day, and in mid-80s the rest of the spring break. So, yeah, it's and Nashville got very little snow that whole front that went through. So it's crazy how the sports or the weather world affects the Southeast. And now that everybody that came to listen to sports is fully aware that we're getting snow down here, but – you know, it's no different than the Super Bowl and NFL talk, because that and Richard Sherman and will Peyton Manning retire has just flooded the airways the last week, because there's not been a lot to talk about. So they've talked a lot about the weather for the Super Bowl as well. So I'll give us a 5-minute pass on our podcast. But there have been some things that have occurred in the SEC, and we'll try to touch on some of those. National Signing Day is now officially, I think it's a week away from where we are now. This time, 1 week from this time, the dust is settling. Everybody's able to kind of see where they're going to pan out and who the winner and who the losers are at this point. So it's getting exciting. And you guys had a big win this week or this weekend in the recruiting front down in Alabama even.
Yeah, you know, it was two big recruiting weekends back-to-back, and Alabama's been fielding several big-time recruits from the 2014 class. And it was kind of an interesting weekend because not only, and I'm sure we'll get to basketball talk later, but Alabama also had a notable decommitment from the 2015 class. And it was the number one quarterback in the 2015 class. Apparently, you know, it seems that he wanted to play for Doug Nussmeier, and so he decommitted. He's now committed to USC. But are you talking about Jonathan Ledbetter, the defensive tackle? Is that who you're talking about?
No, I was talking about your quarterback apparent from Florida State.
Oh, sorry. Coker, right.
See, we got a quarterback.
Old news to me. Yeah, you know, Jacob Coker. There's been speculation all year long that it's always weird. He's an Alabama kid. I believe he went to St. Paul's, which oddly enough is the same high school that A.J. McCarron graduated from. So he was kind of the heir apparent to A.J. McCarron down there. And now Alabama has his solid commitment as soon as he graduates to come play quarterback. And, you know, it was kind of funny on Twitter if you watch everybody talk. Everybody's already crowning him as the next guy. Alabama's got some pretty good young talent. It's just going to be, obviously, he'll have, you know, game experience to bring to the table, but they're going to have system experience with Lane Kiffin. And a lot of people are speculating, it's kind of weird. He will be a junior next year, but he's graduating either in the spring or fall or the spring or summer, depending on how his classes work out. So he'll have 2 years of eligibility left, and he's transferring to play right away. You know, that was kind of the lure of getting him, I guess. So, yeah, you're right. Sorry. That totally escaped my mind.
No, I mean, if you keep up with the recruiting front at all, and I don't, and even I am fully aware of the fact that he's basically going to commit to you guys since the national championship game was over almost a month ago. I mean, it's been old news. It's just that finally the actual, I guess, verbal commitment says, yes, I'm coming to Alabama. Kind of thing. It just came down over the weekend. So you're right in the fact that for many it was not a surprise that it actually happened. I think people would have been more surprised if all of a sudden he went somewhere else.
That is true because, you know, like you said, we've been hearing talk of that for months now, it seems like, even though it's only been a month. But another thing is, Shane, is I was looking at this, and Tony, our editor over at Bama Hammer, he actually posted this pretty interesting video that has every single play of Jacob Coker's career at far, or at least from this season the 2013 season, and obviously he didn't get much game time because even though Florida State was blowing out teams, they would leave Jameis Winston in until the third and fourth quarter. But he actually has less pass attempts than Alabama's backup quarterback from this last season, Blake Sims, who's a converted running back. He's a running style quarterback. He's attempted 41 passes in his career, and I think Jacob Coker at Florida State attempted 39. So all this like game experience stuff, bringing him in, and he's an experienced guy. The numbers don't really say that, but I guess only time will tell.
Yeah, but I mean, from what I've seen and heard, is that he battled some injuries over the spring and into the summer. But before that, though, he was really the quarterback for Florida State, and because of those injuries, Jameis was able to come in, do what he did. All of a sudden, there was a battle. He wasn't exactly where they wanted him to be as health wise. So, you know, the rest is history at that point. And how many times have you seen an injury set back a quarterback, and all of a sudden he's – and this happens in the NFL all the time. Now he has to take second fiddle to the backup. That's kind of what happened down in Florida State. And all of a sudden you have the hot hand. You can't not go with him because when it all boiled down to it as far as talent goes, Coker was right up there, and in some situations and some areas more talented. So, you know, when you look at that, you have a lot of unproven talent, and, you know, you've got the ability to come in, and, you know, he's learned systems. It's not like a freshman coming in brand new that's got to learn what a college system looks like, what a college practice is like. He's well entrenched in all of that, and you're bringing in the maturity level and the talent on top of that. It's going to be hard for one of your new guys to beat that kind of game time, and even though it's not actual on the field, but that kind of experience, it's going to be hard to beat those kind of intangibles.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think we had this conversation at the beginning of the year, maybe even last summer before the year even started, is we talked about Jeremy Johnson for Auburn, who is a local product out of Montgomery, a really great quarterback, and is seemingly the future of Auburn football. From quarterback standpoint, after Nick Marshall graduates, or, you know, whenever his eligibility runs out, whatever happens. But we talked about that, you know, Auburn had essentially once again handpicked Nick Marshall from a JUCO. I think we get that same vibe. I don't know about you. Like you said, he gave Jameis a run from his money from what many sources say down in Tallahassee. But this seems kind of like Nick Saban has gotten his guy. And it's going to be really hard to think that unless Jacob Coker doesn't perform the way that he's expected to, that he will not get that job. Because he was kind of handpicked. You don't get a guy that is going to transfer from a situation and play instantly. It's the same way with JUCO in my mind. And
yes, no, you're right.
It's interesting because this is really Alabama's biggest hole, right? I mean, you're replacing a guy that had a great season, a great career at Alabama, and somebody's got to step into his shoes. And once Alabama, you know, we also, I don't know if you guys talked about this, but Luke Del Rio, Jack Del Rio's son, who was a walk-on in Alabama, was, from what we heard, leading the quarterback competition in that third spot, and really the second spot, because no one really thinks that Blake Sims would be a starter. But and he transferred out, so that was another kind of prereq to Jacob Coker coming in. So,
yeah, I think it's a big win for you guys. I'm excited for you. I think that from a talent perspective, he brings that type of – you're right. I like the way you compare him to a JUCO because he's going to have that experience, except what you don't have with him and what is seen with Nick Saban and his programs, he doesn't have that type of baggage that a JUCO star generally comes in with.
That's true.
You know, you've got you can just go over and over again all the issues that you have – when you have a JUCO guy come in. You know, Nick Marshall had a troubled pass before he got to Auburn, and winning kind of makes you forget those things. And so did Cam Newton, for that matter. I mean, he accused of stealing laptops in Florida. You know, basically got kicked off of that program to end up back at Auburn. Marshall was at Georgia before, correct?
Right. He was a cornerback at Georgia. So.
So, I mean, you know, you have all these things that affect a JUCO that Nick Saban doesn't want. He doesn't want that kind of cancer in his program, and he's getting that type of player, that type of experience without that type of baggage. So,
yep, I think you're right. And that's a great way to look at it. I hadn't even really thought about it that way, but, you know, and let's be honest, he has to be a pretty good quarterback if Florida State recruited him and all this talk. I mean, I'm a little skeptical just because I've kind of already convinced myself that, hey, Alabama's going to be a run-first team. We can't hype it up because we're losing one of the greatest quarterbacks in Alabama history. We're going to go back to this Nick Saban game manager role that we had with Greg McElroy and John Parker Wilson before that. But, hey, if he
and AJ
just comes
McCarron,
out here and slings the ball and, you know, Lane Kiffin at the helm, that would make me excited. I don't know about you.
Now, you know, he might not be able to join in practice and stuff, but you know that he's having regular conversations with Lane Kiffin. You know he's examining playbooks. He's getting started in that arena. So even though he might not be there for some of the spring drills to be with the team, he's going to know and be ready when he gets onto campus what he needs to do, what he needs to work on, and where the program's going to be headed by under his arm. And, you know, you've got a great opportunity with Lane Kiffin to prove his worth. All of a sudden, you know, he can come in, make that splash, and he might only be there a year or two because he's a beaten, broken-down man. I don't know if you heard him right before the national championship. He was on Dan Patrick. And, you know, I've gone all over the dial with this guy. You know, at first I thought when he first got there, I thought he was going to be the best thing for Tennessee. And then I saw how much of a punk and arrogant man he was and how he left the program over there. And as a non-Tennessee fan, that kind of made me happy. But from a impartial standpoint, I thought he was a good hire at the time. He decimated that program. You know, went to USC, just couldn't do things there. Got kicked out of there halfway through. If you heard that interview, I mean, you truly saw a humbled, beaten, broken man. Who knows what that means long term? If some of those things that got him into trouble from an arrogant standpoint will subside or not? We don't know. That's going to be yet to be seen. But what you do have is a guy that's ready to prove something again.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right in that fire that he may have. I think is really good. I mean, he's a great coach and a great offensive coach if you look back at the USC days. But just to hit on the point you were talking about, I can't, just in my mind, I can't really think of a guy who's been to the highest of highs and the lowest of lows within, say, a 10 to 15 year period other than Lane Kiffin, and he's got multiple chances. And this Alabama job could be another springboard to, who knows, maybe another coaching job. He gets so many more opportunities, and I don't know if that's honestly because he's a great offensive coach or whether that's just because of his name or what it is. And I'm with you. I was the same way with him at Tennessee. You know, I thought he was going to bring the fire back into the Tennessee program that it's been known for, and it just didn't happen. And as a matter of fact, he's put them in a hole that they're still digging out of this day. So
yeah, no, long term, it ended up being a good thing for me, being a fan of teams other than Tennessee. You know, it ended up being a good thing for me.
Oh, yeah, me too, obviously.
But, you know, I can't say that his name means as much anymore, not only with what he's been able to do, but look at what his dad's not been able to do. I mean, since he left Tampa, you know, he's not been effective. He's not been effective in the college arena. He wasn't effective in any of his positions. Was he at Dallas this year?
I think so. And what were they, the worst defensive, one of the worst in history?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, all this talk about this defensive genius, you know, when he got to Tennessee, he's like, oh, he's bringing his dad. This defense is going to be unbelievable. Well, he's proven, for some reason, that he's forgotten everything that he's known. I don't know what he did to do that. That one baffles me. Is the Monty Kiffin part of this whole scenario, is that, you know, as soon as he leaves Tampa, he's been in shambles with defenses. And it's not because of talent, because he's got tons of talent in all these programs that he's been at. Tennessee, USC, Dallas, I don't know. So, you know, even that part of his legacy has been tarnished and damaged But winning has such a short-term memory on individuals. I mean, look at what Louisville did. Bobby Petrino just basically, you know, they had a big slogan up there. It was when he was there originally. It was called "L Yes." You know, he said, "L Yes, I'm leaving," right? You know, yeah. And they welcome him back with open arms. You know, ecstatic. They're going, you know, we couldn't have got a better coach to fill these shoes up in Louisville than Bobby Petrino from leaving Western. You know, so winning can do so many things in those situations, and he's been given such a great opportunity at Alabama. I see him back as a head coach soon if he can keep doing what he's supposed to be doing there.
Yeah, and yeah, I don't want to make any sweeping, just say anything sweepingly. Anyway, so you know, we heard about Bobby Petrino, and all I heard when he got fired at Arkansas is this man will never coach again. And granted, you know, where is he back at? He's back at Louisville, who is, I mean, given they haven't really gotten to the top yet, but they're always in the high, you know, the talks of the top 25, the top 15 with Teddy Bridgewater there.
They were BCS national championship talk this year,
yeah,
because they were undefeated at one point. The wheels kind of fell off, and it was exposed on they weren't really as good as that undefeated record was proving to be. But I mean, you were getting that kind of conversation out of Louisville,
right? And now, you know, I would before this job, I would kind of venture to say that, well, what is Lane Kiffin going to do now? Is he going to, you know, be the next guy to get a job at ESPN? But under the grasp of Nick Saban, what many people think that Nick Saban's going to kind of hold him back, and if Alabama continues their winning ways, I mean, like you said, winning talks, and I'm sure he'll get a job somewhere. So. Yeah. It's just a weird situation.
Any other football talk that we need to talk about? We discussed this, and you weren't able to join us, but what are your thoughts as an outsider of the James Franklin Vanderbilt situation?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting because I didn't follow it completely, but I did see his departure. It was pretty nice. Didn't he pull out like a full-page advertisement or whatever that was, thanking all the Vanderbilt players and everything. But there was a whole debacle, or whatever it was. You may have to describe it to me. It went on there for days, and he said he was staying, and then he left.
It was a half-page ad in the Tennessean, which is the Nashville paper, and it ended up being paid for by Penn State.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that part. Okay.
So... yeah, it was actually paid for by Penn State. It wasn't even coming out of James Franklin. And it was only like $2,500. You know, the guy got a $4.5 million contract, yeah. and Penn State ponied up the $2,500. It's just a bad PR move. Even, you know, the PR department at Penn State, the marketing department, should have known, and some of that's got to go on them, is that, you know, even if we say, James Franklin, send in an expense report and we're going to pay you back for this.
Yeah,
they needed to let James Franklin's credit card be the one to pay for that.
That's right. And I don't know. I mean, just thinking about, you have a better grasp on how Nashville feels about this and how the whole Vanderbilt community does. I think he's left Vanderbilt in a great situation, and I think they've got a great hire. The guy that they got from Stanford, many have said that he was obviously David Shaw's top assistant, and he was even one of the top assistants under Harbaugh when he was there, I think. So I think that's – they got a great hire. They got another guy that kind of screams Vanderbilt to me.
Yes. You know,
that's just what that means, just coming from Stanford and everything. But, I mean, I know you've been high on Vanderbilt as well – or on James Franklin as well. So I think Penn State got a good coach too.
I think – yeah. I think the Vanderbilt fans are – I mean, if you go back and you look at Twitter, I mean, you see them going from loving the guy – to detesting the guy in the matter of a day. And I'm sorry, Vanderbilt fans should have realized, because we've been saying this from the very beginning, yeah, that he's not going to stick around. I mean, I had a candid conversation with a longtime Vanderbilt fan, grad, the whole thing. It's just like, you do understand that he's gone. No, I think we're going to keep him. It's like, no, I'm going to tell you all the reasons why. And it's the same reasons we've said on this podcast in the past, why he's going to leave. And sure enough, he left. And I honestly believe that even though he got paid $1 million more, that wasn't the reason. The reason was he could do so much more up at Penn State with the same amount of effort than he could at Vanderbilt, because no matter how much he got out there, I mean, we've said this on the podcast before, he would actually, there were times where he would actually be walking through the, like, the student halls where they're eating lunches and stuff and say, are you going to be in town on, like, on a fall break? Are you going to be in town? Going to be here for the game? No, I got to go. Well, let's call your parents. And he's physically calling students' parents to say, you know what, let's change that flight and have them fly out the next day so they can come stay at the, see this game. I mean, that's the kind of stuff he had to put up with at Vanderbilt. And it's just because of who the students are. Most of the students aren't from here. They're all going to leave when they graduate. So, and the folks that are in Nashville are not mostly Vanderbilt fans. They're everything else in the SEC. So he had an impossible battle that he could never win unless it's a generational thing. It's the same thing with, like, I'm wearing a Predator shirt here. The Predators here in Nashville, it took a generation. You know, now there is, they've been here since the mid-90s. There's kids now that have grown up knowing the Predators since they were 5 or 6. They're now in high school. They're Predators fans for life now. Well, and they've been successful. The Predators have been pretty successful. Even though they've not gone to the Stanley Cup, they've made the playoffs a number of times. So there's some success built in there. Just like Vanderbilt, there's success built in there. But it's only 3 years, and 3 years does not make a fan base that you have to grow organically from the beginning. And he's just doesn't have that kind of time to spend at Vanderbilt to do that. But you're right about Derek Mason. What a great hire. If you look at Vanderbilt and the way they're structured and the way they have to recruit, you know, he's used to that because that's what Stanford had to do. Stanford had to go after the same caliber and type of player that Vanderbilt does. So he knows how to recruit that player. He's also recruited in the South, so he's got some inroads already down this way, on top of all the other inroads and places that he's able to open up. So for Vanderbilt, I think it was a great hire. I think you're right. I think Penn State got a tremendous hire. But the Vanderbilt fans, I mean, you couldn't believe how quick they were turning their back on Franklin for just leaving them like that. And rightly so. I mean, you know, because he would sit here and get on the radio. I mean, he was relentless at marketing himself and the program. And you know, he would get on the radio stations and the programs here. And he, like last year, blasted a recruit for decommitting, you know, because, you know, you got to stay true to your commitments. And you know, the Vanderbilt fans took that to heart when he didn't do the same thing. You know, when I don't know if it was his first speech here when he came to Vanderbilt, but, you know, he basically said there's the AFC, the NFC, and the SEC. Wow. And so now he's not in any one of those three, you know. So the Vanderbilt fans took all of that stuff to heart. And what you have to realize is that a coach is going to have to be a marketer and a salesperson, because they are always, and I mean always, looking for the next job.
Yeah, you can go if you're not done.
No, but, who is not? I mean, unless you're at the precipice. If you're Nick Saban, you're Les Miles, you don't have to go. But, hey, you know, it doesn't hurt to go talk, because all of a sudden you get a nice little raise. Yeah. But the coaches are always willing to listen. And that's the same with business in general. If you're listening to this and you want business advice, you always should entertain an offer. Doesn't mean you have to accept it, but it's always nice to see what you're worth. And that's exactly what coaches do every single year.
And that's exactly right. And, you know, if I know fandom comes into this, it rules our minds. It takes us over. And to Vanderbilt fans, I would have to say that you got to realize that with your vested interest in the program, it's never going to seem like a clean cut to you when your coach leaves. Obviously, it could have been better. I guess the situation could always be better. But how many times do we really see when a program, especially like Vanderbilt, who James Franklin has poured his life, his heart, everything that he has into it, and then, you know, like you said, you have to realize that, unfortunately, if you're Vanderbilt, that's not a place where a coach is going to – that's not the penultimate place for most coaches. even Derek Mason is probably looking for, you know, maybe this is a stepping stone job to another bigger job if he wants. But I think you said a lot of great points, and hats off to James Franklin. And Derek Mason is in a much better situation than James Franklin was.
Agreed. Completely.
However many years it was. It's probably been six or seven or
three.
Like
he's
that.
Been there three.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. It just seems like longer. But anyway, so I don't know. I mean, I get that, and I really do. Coming from somebody who was caught up in the Nick Saban stuff, you know, in 2007. You know, I mean, that was a weird situation for us at Alabama, and he went to the NFL, and then he had went through all that in Miami, and then he came back up here. Coaching is a business. You have to realize that as much as you want to feel that James Franklin was a Vanderbilt fan at heart, he was a James Franklin fan at heart when it came down to it, and he has to do what's best for him, and now he's getting a paycheck. And
his commitments show that that's true because, I don't know, they went from the top 20 to, like, 65 overnight, basically, in the rankings because of all the decommits. But you said something that made me think that a fan of a team is only happy to see the coach leave when their team's not performing well.
Yeah.
That's the
There's never a good situation when you're a fan when you've got a coach that everybody else wants. I was in that situation, too. I mean, obviously, in the back of my mind, I said, Saban will never go to Texas. You know, Jimmy Sexton is just shopping him around. But we heard those rumors, and for months and months and months, and they never went away. And you had to be ready. I mean, if you know that your coach is somebody that everyone else wants, you have to have that feeling. And, you know, it's a bad feeling. It's just not good at all. But you're exactly right. For instance, UAB just lost Garrick McGee. He didn't get fired. He went. He's actually going to have to pay UAB money to go be Louisville's offensive coordinator. But everybody at UAB is happy because he never performed. You know, that was a
win-win.
Do what?
That was a win-win.
Yeah, exactly. So like you said, the only time that you're glad to see your coach go is when you're Tennessee with Lane Kiffin or, you know, UAB with Garrick McGee or, you know, just name your situation.
Auburn with
Gene Chizik.
There you go. Yeah. It's, you know, so 1 year, 2 years from a national championship. It's just exactly. A fan is never happy, and so that's what's great about college football is because I get to sit over here and make fun of all that, and the thing is it's so two-sided because I'm sitting here and I live and die with UK basketball sometimes. I mean, we're doing this podcast and Nick's watching the game in the background go now, and all I can see is just like one little sliver on your screen. It's like, now are you watching that basketball game right over there in the side? Don't tell me what's happening.
I'm trying not to.
Yeah,
I'm not going to reveal anything, even if we start talking about basketball.
Well, let's change gears and talk about basketball. Unless there's anything else in the football arena we need to cover. Manziel going number one. I saw something about that now. You know, all of a sudden, there's a good chance that he might be the number one quarterback overall taken, as well as the number one overall pick.
Yeah, you know, and it's weird. And that is another way. You know, I'm big
into tech. It's the marketing hype machine all over again. It's just now it's a player, not a coach.
It is. And, you know, this is kind of an interesting example. I'm big into tech as well, and the tech industry can change on a dime. You know, the next day something new comes out, and nothing stays the same. And it's the same way with college football. You know, 3 or 6 months ago we were talking about how Johnny Manziel is too small. Even though he had this outstanding year, he can't reproduce. There's no way that he could put up the stats that he did. And repeat them for this season. There's no way he could repeat as the Heisman, which he didn't, but, you know, he had better stats, some would say. And, you know, now we're talking about him even weeks after people have said that, months after people have said that, we're talking about him going not only the first quarterback chosen in the draft to now the number one overall pick. Who knows? Nothing surprises me now. And he would be an exciting player, that's for sure.
Being Houston having the number one pick and being the AFC South, I don't want to see that. I would like to see him somewhere else so I could watch that excitement elsewhere. But it's ridiculous. And it's all the marketing aspect of it. You know, you've got a machine behind Manziel that's able to get that information out there in such a way that, you know, we're going to put butts in the seats. And at the end of the day, that's what sells a football program. is people in the seats. And so that's what Manziel can bring to some of these programs. Houston was not happy with the way their season went last year. And so, you know, it can add a lot of excitement. It's keeping him in the state of Texas. There's lots of reasons how this makes sense. And I would be marketing it the same way. But you're right. Football and tech have so many similarities. I mean, Apple, look at how many people have an iPhone or an iPad. Yet, you know, today they get blasted, and yesterday they get blasted on their quarterly reports, on their sales and their profits, and they're making money hand over fist, but it's not enough. And right. So, you know, they're not the darling that they once were, but yet they're just still making tons of money. It's silly. All right, now let's go to basketball. I'll say congratulations on a huge win for you guys Saturday. I mean, that was a much needed win, but you almost gave away a 17-point lead.
You know,
were you nervous right there, Nick?
Shane, I was, you know, my heart has become kind of numb to Alabama basketball, and it's one of those things where you just expect the collapse, and I know that that does not sound right, but I'm just sitting here in my mind, I'm watching the game, I'm just thinking about how I'm going to word another recap to where we've surrendered a large lead once again. You know, I use the same phrases over and over again because it seems like the same song, different verse occasionally against Alabama. And Alabama, it's not like they're in the dumps, it seems like it sometimes, but then you come back and you play Florida close, and then you know, blow out LSU, a pretty decent team who's been playing pretty well in the SEC this year in the first half, and then you surrender a 17-point lead, like you said, and surrender 40-something points in the second half. I don't know. It was a big win for us, but I hate to say it was a big win because we had to, of the situation we created for ourselves. I hate that constitutes a big win for us now. You know, I wish we could be sitting here talking about us beating Florida as a big win, because that would be a, you know, top five win as of now. But it didn't happen. You know, we needed that win. It's good momentum going into Alabama plays Auburn on Wednesday. Auburn's lost 16 straight SEC games, and I doubt Alabama wants the first matchup of the Iron Bowl basketball series this year to be that game that breaks that streak. So I don't know. You know, I know Britton and I exchange on Twitter every once in a while our sentiments towards each other and how it's just no fun being an Alabama basketball fan, but some of us are still here. I still write about it every single game, even though it's painful at times, but that's where we are right now.
I mean, so many years you're right there on the cusp of making the tournament. And this year, unfortunately, I think you're going to be right there again. And it's all going to boil down to, you know, like the Tennessees of the SEC. You know, are they going to perform where they need to perform and win the games that they have to win and sneak out a couple that they should be able to win? If they play right. And that's the same situation that Alabama's in. I mean, you look at the SEC, and unfortunately, you know, right now, I put on the pre-show notes, and we talked about this. It's a reversal. You know, you look at the end of the season football rankings, and five teams are in the top seven, and they're all from the SEC. You have to look at the top 25, and you can only find two teams. One of them in the top 10, one of them in the top five. And the other one, you know, Kentucky's on the door of the top 10 again. But you look at that and you go, the strength's just not there. And I don't know if you listened to our last podcast where I gave my theory on ways that could be corrected if they start paying players, and how there's a great opportunity for that. But I think there's an answer long term for the SEC to get those five, six teams in the tournament every year. But this year it's not that way. Right now Missouri wants to give away their chances because, you know, at the beginning of the SEC play, you know, there were three solid programs. Could we get a fourth or a fifth if they got hot? What was the talk? And now you're looking at the SEC and you go, I would like to get three. You know, we're going to be lucky if we get four.
Yeah, we're trying to find three or four. And, you know, not to get off topic, but Missouri's been one of the more surprising teams for me this year. I knew they lost a couple guys, including Phil Pressey, who was kind of their emotional leader last season, but they had such a great non-conference run. I mean, they didn't have too many intriguing wins, but they won the games that they should have, and you looked at them coming into SEC play. And I even saw on my Twitter feed not too long ago that they struggled tonight against Arkansas. I mean, they pulled out the victory, but I think you're exactly right. And, you know, basketball is kind of in the SEC standard, or SEC-wise, it's much more in flux, but we are spoiled a little bit. But I know with you and I, people who actually care just as much about SEC basketball as we do football, you kind of look at the fall sports in football and you just say, you know, what's happening here? Where's the drop-off? Because so many teams like Alabama and even Tennessee, like you said, LSU, they really believe that they should have teams that are at least in the conversation to make the tournament every year. And like you said, Alabama, especially under Anthony Grant, has seemingly been in that position one too many times and is going to be in there again this year, and they almost always fall on the wrong side of the bubble, which is pretty disconcerting. But it comes down to play on the court. Normally Alabama loses a lot of December and November games that they shouldn't. This year they stacked the non-conference schedule a lot more, and they didn't win any of the games that they shouldn't have, because they played Wichita State, who's a top 10 team, I believe, now, and I lost to Florida at home the other night by, you know, less than 10 points. I think it was like 6 or 7. You know, at some point you have to break that mindset, I guess you would say, and you've got to win some of these games that you shouldn't. And I feel like that's kind of a temperament in the SEC together. You know, you've got Florida and Kentucky who consistently run the game, and then you've got teams like Missouri and LSU and Tennessee and Alabama who are kind of the second tier who show signs of greatness at times, but they just can't get those wins against, you know, national contenders or even conference opponents.
And you say that you could actually add South Carolina, Georgia, and Mississippi State to that, because at times there's flashes of greatness in all of those programs. Vanderbilt too, you know, that's a team that just has been destroyed with, you know, one problem after another. They're down to 7 scholarship players. You know, I think they were holding open auditions if you can pass the SAT and you've got, some skills. We might be able to get you as a walk-on here to Vanderbilt last week. I think I saw that coming over the radio. I'm kidding about that. But, I mean, it's that bad right now at Vanderbilt that they're hobbling along. They're you know, they've got players that just aren't making the grade, literally and figuratively, and having to set out the entire season. And that was a program that was already young and was in the rebuilding process. But, you know, you look at that, and all of a sudden you're down to another 8 of the 8 teams. So, you know, there's just 4 bottom dwellers. But none of those 8 teams can get to a level year in and year out to get some consistency to allow for the tournament to get those guys in. And there's going to have to be, with all the injection of money coming in with the SEC network, there has to be more emphasis from these programs. And you're going to see Mike Schlav do this, whether he comes out and says it or not. You're going to see more emphasis come from basketball, because you need that to be relevant. You don't have to have them be the old Big East of basketball and have, you know, 10 teams coming into the tournament every year. But you have to have this conference relevant every year, not only to help the Kentucky and Florida out in the world, but also to help just the overall ranking and eyeballs, so that you have eyeballs from February to the end of March. And you have some eyeballs through the week in September, October, November, December, on some of these basketball games that you're going to be able to show on the SEC network. Otherwise, you're going to be showing, you know, Air Rifle and Luge or something silly like that. But, I mean, all these other strange collegiate sports that we have out there, and not that any of these players and participants are not talented. It's just It's not what fans want to watch. I mean, you go from the Iron Bowl, which got a 87 rating as far as TV viewers in Birmingham. I mean, that means 87% of all the television households in the Birmingham area had that game on. That's, I mean, and I don't remember the national number, but it was a 30 or a 40. It was a crazy number. So you know you have the data that says that folks want to watch this. You have the data that says people care about the SEC. You got to give them something to care about year-round. And as much as you want to do it, there's not enough to do just football 24/7, 365.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, from a fan's point of view, I kind of wish that, you know, this would have been more of an emphasis beforehand, you know, before the last couple of years, as a matter of fact. But you're right. With the rise of the SEC network, there's going to be a push, not only from Mike Five, but the rest of the SEC to its members, that we have to make basketball relevant again. And Shane, I think you're right. I don't think we have to be the old Big East. I think we can define relevancy as a pretty lower standard than what most people think. You know, we're just asking for four or five teams in the championship or in the tournament. You know,
we have 14 teams. That's less. That's well less than half to make the tournament. That's not a hard thing to ask when you're looking at a what we call a super conference. To get that kind of result. So,
and one thing I would point to is, you talked about this before, is Mississippi State and Vanderbilt have essentially become absent in the SEC's basketball scene. And those are two programs that, along with Kentucky and Florida, 5 or 6 years ago, not even 5 or 6 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, that you knew were going to be a hard game on your SEC schedule. Now, granted, in the state the SEC is right now, anybody could beat anybody other than outside of Florida and Kentucky. But I think you're right. You know, you look at that Vanderbilt team from 3 or 4 years ago, there's two or three guys that played for them that are in the NBA right now. Yeah. We're not talking about great college players.
They had five players leave for a draft, whether it was to play in Europe or to play here that year, 2 years ago. Five, maybe six. It was ridiculous. Yeah, so They have the ability to be relevant. I mean, and another team that we were rattling off, we didn't even talk about Arkansas when you were saying that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they could find a way to win on the road, they're almost unbeatable at home. They look completely different. And you know, when they entered the SEC in the 80s, you know, that was a program that Kentucky hated to see every time they played them. And we still don't like to see them. We don't fear them as much. We should. We should have. I mean, they beat us in their court. But, you know, that's another program. So you're looking at it. All of these programs have the potential. They're missing something. And I feel like what my thesis was when we were talking a couple weeks ago was that, you know, once you start paying players, it doesn't just stop with paying players. You know, that just kind of opens the door. So, you know, the NCAA was talking about, should we play collegiate players? Well, yeah, if they start doing that and all of a sudden the SEC starts get, or the players start getting a stipend, well, on under the table is going to be even more. So all of a sudden you're going to make that have and have nots even more apparent, because your Butlers and your Wichita States of the world could not compete year in and year out with 14 teams in the SEC that's got the deepest pockets in the world, or the Big Ten or the Big 12 or the ACC, where all these boosters have all this money to be able to help in those situations. And help is not the right word, because it's illegal, but it's going to happen. And all of a sudden you're going to have all of this so that the max amount's going to be able to be given with the SEC, and they wouldn't have to blink, because all the revenue that's coming in off of the new TV deal on top of the money they're getting right now, it would be a drop in the bucket. And all of a sudden you're making your basketball players relevant, because they're going to be able to provide something that other programs can't. So I think you're going to start to see the divide in basketball if you start paying college players for that reason. I don't know if this was going to be true or not. I made this up off the fly a couple weeks ago. But when you look at it and you logically work through this, you go, that kind of makes sense because it's happening in football.
Yeah, and, you know, basketball, even though it's frustrating to me, not only as an Alabama fan, but also as an SEC fan, that you know, we can't get people that can beat these Wichita States and VCUs. But at the same time, that's something that I look forward to every single March, every single year in college basketball, is seeing what mid-major team or what Cinderella is going to be able to pull off an upset and make it to the Final Four, because that is one of the things that we have when you get, 67 or 68 teams into the tournament now, is about 60 of those teams have a shot to at least make it to the Sweet 16. I mean, there's such a level playing field, especially when it comes to March. But like you said, if you get to that point, there's going to be a huge divide, just as there is in college football. And from an SEC standpoint, you know, we look at from the top of the mountain and we say, wow, you know, how awesome is this divide? You know, no one can compete with us. I mean, granted, Florida State won, but we still had, you know, Auburn competing for the national championship. But I think there would be even more pushback from a national standpoint if that happened.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it over the last 5 to 7 years in college basketball, you've really seen a divide where you could say there's the potential for a 1 seed to lose to a 16 seed.
Oh, yeah.
5 years ago, you would never have that thought in your head. But today, because you're seeing some more, like you said, some leveling of that playing field, and because there's so few players needed to all of a sudden make yourself relevant in this talk, that you're starting to see that gap get smaller. You've seen a 2 beat a 15, a 15 beat a 2. So, and you've seen some ones take a 16 to the very end. And that didn't happen 5-10 years ago. And so all of that you've worked at and that you've built at to get this could just fall apart and crumble. And like you said, the divide would become greater. And the SECs of the world or the Big Tens are gonna be saying, look at us, we're the benefactors of this.
Yeah, and just one more thing on this point. I look at VCU, which is where Alabama's current head coach Anthony Grant came from, and his successor in Shaka Smart. And, you know, he was the hottest name in college basketball. He still is, really, but on the coaching market. And VCU has completely committed themselves to college basketball, and I don't know that much about their program, but they probably have a pretty – decent athletic budget, but they're literally pouring almost all of that into college basketball. And to that effect, no one can hire Shaka Smart away from VCU. And that's what you get, is you get these teams that have a specialized basketball interest like VCU, and there you go. You know, you've got them. They can compete with anybody in the nation. And I kind of want to preserve that, but at the same time, like you said, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, there was never a chance for that to happen, but now there is.
Yeah. Well, Nick, is there anything else you've got to cover you want to talk about? I think I've covered all the topics I had in my head.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earlier, not only with things going on, that this is a more of a 10-day podcast, but let's just whisper in the SEC's ear, if we are relevant in basketball, we might could justify doing a weekly podcast again, you know?
You make such a good point. I mean, it's hard to come on here and not have the relevancy to talk about it. It's, I mean, as a Kentucky fan, I could sit here and talk Kentucky basketball for the whole time. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm KSR, and I don't want to be Kentucky Sports Radio. We're SEC SRT. We want to talk about all the teams. And right now it's in the basketball realm. It's painful to have to do that sometimes. And you're right. I would love to be able to say, you know, I'm so excited that this basketball season is so awesome that we're going to do this every other day. Right. And basketball has so many more games. I mean, you've got 2 games a week in the SEC where you're looking at 1 game in football. And yet you look at it, it's just like, do we really want to talk about how bad a team lost that they should have won? I mean, and that is a broken record over and over through the whole SEC. I mean, right now Kentucky's losing to LSU. I mean, I hope they come back and say we get to say that they pulled this one out. But come on, all the talent that Kentucky has, they shouldn't be losing to LSU. But yet here we are midway through the second period and they're losing to LSU.
Yep. The only other thing, you know, you referenced it before, just things going on until next time we talk or whenever that is. We do have National Signing Day coming up. State of Alabama, that's a huge deal. You know, we make a big deal about the faxes and all that stuff in the athletic department. But at Bama Hammer, if you guys ever check it out, we're going to be in full signing day mode. You know, a lot of us are going to be working overtime, I guess you could say. I'm writing up 5 to 10 guys who we think are possible commits, and then if they commit, we'll you know, post a post about them and say, you know, just a short post saying how they're going to fit at Alabama or whatever. And that's an exciting day all over the SEC and even at Vanderbilt and places like that, just seeing that, you know, almost any SEC program can now pull a 4 or 5 star guy, and it's just so much fun. You know, last year we really got that feeling with Ole Miss. You know, Ole Miss just kept racking in guys, and the faxes just kept coming in, and, you know, they were sweeping off these 4 and 5 star guys. And to be honest with you, as an SEC fan, I don't know about you, Shane, but it's one of my favorite days of the year that has really sometimes it has a big impact on the field aspects, but, you know, sometimes we never hear from these guys again. But it's just, I don't know, it's kind of theater of the mind in a way. You know, we're creating all this hype. But
I'm dating myself, and I can't even remember the full quote, but have you seen the movie Beautiful Girls?
I have not.
Okay. It's a must watch. It's loaded with stars. Matt Dillon, Michael Rapaport, the guy that was on Leverage, Timothy Hutton, Rosie O'Donnell, she had a part in there, but Lauren Hunter, I think, it's just top-notch talent. Uma Thurman's in it, and then a lot of names that you would see them on the screen, you go, oh, yeah, man, I know they've been in a bunch of stuff. But it was a really good movie, but I say that to say Michael Rapaport goes on this big, long monologue about, you know, beautiful girls and models and how it's you know, it's hope springing eternal. It's new life. And that's what signing day is it's all new and pretty. And, you know, when you're just like going out on your first date, there's all that excitement. The world is at your fingertips, so you can't do anything wrong. It's just you're destined for greatness because of what you're bringing in. And that's kind of what signing day does, is it's all of that rejuvenation. All the past can be forgotten and all the good times are ahead of us kind of feel.
Yeah, and, you know, also that was an amazing, much better description than I could ever give. But, you know, as SEC fans, we always look, every so often we look for, you know, just times to talk about football. So in February, we have signing day. In April, we have all the spring games. You know, in July or whatever it is, we have SEC media days. So every so often, we just have to work football into there.
Yeah, the SEC does a NCAA does a pretty good job of at least making the collegiate football relevant for a big portion of the offseason. And it's by design. I mean, the NFL has done that for years. And the SEC and all the other collegiate programs are getting into it as well. So it gives us something to talk about a month after the national championship, and we'll be able to talk about that and carry that information on for another couple weeks. And, you know, before you know it, spring practices will be here, and then all the scrimmages will be here, and it doesn't stop. I mean, if you listen to the podcast over the last 2-3 years we've done these, you know, all the way up through the spring, it really gets to late April, May, and June before you really start hitting the bottom of the barrel of things to talk about in the college football ranks.
Yep, and, you know, according to Blair, we do have college baseball coming up, and I'm hoping, as an Alabama fan, as a student, that I have something to talk about, so maybe one day we'll have, you know, College World Series talks with Blair and I, and just maybe Alabama will do something this year that they haven't been able to do in a while. So
when we do, I'll moderate.
Exactly.
All right, guys, I'm going to call this podcast done.